So we are so glad you're here. Thank you for being here. How many of you folks are here for the very first time? First time tonight? Well, great. We are glad that you are here. Thank you for coming. For those of you who don't know, I'm Frank Loria, one of the elders here at Lakeview Christian Center. I have the joy of being here. This is fun. And I hope you agree. I'm sure you enjoyed your meal. And hopefully dessert as well. So, hey, yesterday was St. Patrick's Day. I'm sure you all knew that. How many Irish do we have in the room? Okay, a few Irish. We don't care, but that's nice. But I thought I would bring to you the top five Irish jokes. Okay, you ready? Right. These are, well, the top five clean Irish jokes. Okay, here we go. How did the Irish jig, you don't want to miss this. How did the Irish jig get started? Too much to drink and not enough restrooms. I have to think about that for a second. Hey, why do leprechauns make good secretaries? Shorthand. They're great at shorthand. Correct. What do you get when you cross Quasimodo with an Irish football player? The halfback of Notre Dame. Sure, man. Oh, what's the main difference between an Irish wedding and an Irish funeral? One less drunk at the party. Okay, my favorite. This is my favorite. Please, Victor, don't tell the answer. What's Irish and stays out all night? Patio furniture. Thank you for coming. Good night. That's right. Yeah. All right. Patio furniture. That's just my favorite. And by the way, I know I do this. Quick review. If you were not with us last week, you know, much of our conversation centered around faith. You know, we typically think of faith and we put faith in a religious context. But you and I, we exercise faith all the time, multiple times through a day. We exercise faith. And I want to show you just something which is called just a simple model of logic. And I want you to think through this with me because this is really a process of thought that you and I exercise all the time without necessarily even knowing it. So everyone has a worldview, okay? And a worldview is basically a grid or a framework by which we try to make sense out of life. We want things to fit into that grid, that faith grid, that belief grid. And when something falls out of it, it's challenging to our worldview. So every one of us, it doesn't matter whether you're Bill Gates, it doesn't matter what your, you know, socioeconomic status is, everyone. Doesn't matter whether they're PhDs or didn't graduate from middle school. Everyone has a worldview, a philosophy of life. And everyone's worldview or philosophy of life is based on presuppositions, things that we suppose are true. Okay? And then every presupposition is founded in faith. We believe those presuppositions. Now, every faith position is supported by an authority who says so. But every authority is going to be validated by evidence. Okay? You have a pain in your side. It won't go away. You go to a doctor. You sit there in his waiting room or her waiting room. What are you looking for? I'm looking for certificates and fellowships. I'm looking to find any friend that I have that has had some similar situation. And what doctor did you go to? I'm looking to get all of the evidence I can get so that I can make an informed faith decision about who I should be seeing. Can we do that all? Whether it's the schools in which we go to, the neighborhoods in which we live, we're looking for evidence to support whose word we're going to take and what faith position we're going to have and what action will come as a result of that. And it seems like the older we get, the more gravity is attached to the decisions, the faith decisions that we make, the more serious they are, the more the ramifications are if we make the wrong decision, the wrong investment, we go to the wrong doctor, we live in the wrong neighborhood, whatever that may be. But you remember some of the things that we believed as kids? Some of the things we believed as kids? I'm going to let some of you older folks finish this statement. Step on a crack, you break your mother's back. Now, did we actually believe that? I mean, I remember sometimes with my mom, I was so angry with her, I would just run outside and look for the crack. It never worked. But, I mean, these are true. I mean, some of these other things that we may have believed. How about this? If you swallow watermelon seeds, an entire watermelon will grow inside of you. I mean, so you heard that, huh? Well, I was with my mom one day at the grocery store, and this is what I saw. And it's like, I mean, she's holding a watermelon. She's holding a watermelon. How about this, kids? If you urinate in a pool, there's a special dye that turns it bright red so everyone will know. Do you remember that? Okay, let me we're getting to know one another. It's week 2. How many of you have never peed in a pool? We want to see you liars. Okay, look at this. I mean, what? All right, Steve, pay particular attention to her there. I mean, there's so much water in the pool. What's the little gonna make? I mean, that's just, okay, now, I mean, but we just, you know, you just believe that, and you know, and you're looking like an Irish jig because you got to get to the pool. But this one right here, this is. Now, for you younger ones here, you may want to close your eyes right now and cover your ears because, I mean, it's happened. He's just gone, you know? I mean, he's just. But we believe that, right? And this elf on the shelf thing, if anything drives me crazy, it's this manipulation. Yeah, the elf just went to Santa. And the elf was telling Santa everything you've done. And then you have to put the elf somewhere else. It's like, what do we do this? But today we make decisions that have, like I said, more gravity to them. Whether we're driving on a highway, the medications, you go to a pharmacist, you trust that the pharmacist got your order right and that you actually got the order that he or she filled, didn't get crossed over. Look, we don't know, and we really don't know. We don't know that we'll make it back to our pillows tonight. I mean, more than likely we will, but we don't know that. We don't know that. And, you know, it's interesting. In the 24-hour period of March 18, on average, 150,000 people will not make it through the day. In the United States, an average of 7,700 people, 7,700 people will not make it back to their pillows. Now, I'm not telling you that to scare you. Well, maybe a little. But this is what, again, I'm hoping we will think. Last week we talked about life in the dash, this line of this linear life that we have, and none of us knows how we're all closer to our last heartbeat for sure. But the question of what's on the other side of that, and how does my confidence of what's on the other side of that affect the way I live today? And I would argue, and I'm not expecting you to believe me, and I don't want you to believe me, I want you to check this out for yourself, that what we believe about the line, what's going to happen on the other side of our last heartbeat, affects how we live in the dash. So we'll talk more about that, particularly next week in week 4. Now, tonight's topic, we're on page 12 in our study guide. Look, if tonight's topic, if it's true, You know, you and I have taken lots of tests in our lives. Okay, if you're an attorney, you sat for the bar exam. If you're a medical doctor, you had to take many boards and all those other things. If you got an MBA, you have to study for that. Whatever, whether you're in fourth grade or, you know, in higher education, you have to study. There's tons of questions that are being asked, and you got to get the answer right in the dash. But if the Bible is the truth, there is no question that we have to answer correctly more than this one. Who is Jesus? Now, personally, I believed in a Jesus Christ. I believed in a Jesus that did not exist. I created, within my own understanding of religion, I created a fictitious character named Jesus who was based on a true story, but I didn't know the true story. See, when I was introduced to the Jesus of the Bible and the Jesus of history, not the one I had created in my own mind out of my own personal stereotyping convenience, and I became a follower of Jesus Christ some almost 49 years ago, he changed my life completely. But it was then, somewhat ironic, it was then that I actually began to look into some of the evidence and said, does this make any sense? I know I feel different. I can sense that I'm different, but why? Is there anything to support? Is there anything, any real reason to believe? Is there any reason to believe? Can I reason and believe what I actually have shifted my worldview into believing? Because my worldview prior to that was, I'm in control. My worldview prior to that is, I'm making deals with God. I'm being good, so he's got to give me what I want. I'm being bad, so he's off the hook. I mean, this is kind of the worldview that I had, a particularly religious worldview. And so when I looked at this again, and I looked at these things, my worldview suddenly shifted. And again, I'm not asking you to believe this, but this is what my experience was. My worldview changed to where I became a follower of Jesus Christ, and now my faith position was that he really is God, and that the authority was the Bible. But the question is this: where's the evidence to believe that? Why should I believe that? This book, it's been around for thousands of years. Why should I believe that? Well, the first thing we want to take a look at is, it's on page 12, is that Jesus existed. Okay, there is not a critically thinking, rational, unbiased historian who believes that Jesus of Nazareth was a fable. If so, you have to basically throw away all other historic figures of antiquity. You got to throw out Attila the Hun. You got to throw out Caesar. You got to throw out Plato. You got to throw out all of these. And so there's really not a rational, unbiased individual that's going to say that he was just a figment of ignorant people's imagination. We have extra-biblical historical accounts, as a matter of fact. In other words, historians, Roman historians, Greek historians, not proponents, antagonists of Christianity, that recorded a person of Jesus or Christ or Christus in the scriptures. Even within the Jewish Talmud, the person of Jesus is there. So here's, I could give you a bunch of these, but just one. Cornelius Tacitus, I mean, you do see the family resemblance, I'm sure, but he's considered the foremost Roman historian. He was Roman senator. He wrote volumes called the Annals of Rome, 30 books that made up the history of Rome. He wrote in about 116 AD, he wrote the Annals. And this is what he said about Jesus. He said, consequently, to get rid of the report that Nero had Rome burned, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Now, the abominations of the Christians were this. They didn't believe, they were not polytheists. They were monotheists. They didn't believe in all the earth, wind, and fire gods. And these were their abominations, that they were monotheists. He goes on to say, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. Now, Tacitus is no friend of Christianity, but just by him reporting the news, he articulates Jesus of Nazareth and who he was. So, but what about the Bible? What about the Bible that has so much to say about Jesus? How do we know this New Testament hasn't been changed over the years? How can we possibly know what the original documents said? Well, there is tremendous evidence to support that. Now, tonight in your books, I want you to take your pen, if you would. You don't have to do this, but I think this will help you. I think you'll appreciate some of the evidence that is there. Now, there's a literary science which is called textual criticism, okay? And in textual criticism basically is a science which is exercised as it pertains to ancient documents and ancient manuscripts. This is before the printing press. This is before Gutenberg's printing press. This is when all copies of papers were manuscripts, okay, right? The word manu, hand scripts written, handwritten, okay? And so this science is determined, it's rather used to determine the accuracy of ancient documents. And within textual criticism is a particular test called the bibliographical test. Now, the bibliographical test has three aspects to this, okay? If this is boring you to death, just take a nap. We'll wake you up. But so within the bibliographical test, there is this. One, the quantity of manuscripts, okay? That's the first test, quantity of manuscripts. In other words, how many do we have still existing? Because the original autograph is no longer with us. It has disintegrated, okay? But we have manuscripts. We have hand copies. So within the bibliographical test, how many do we have? How many copies do we have of that ancient manuscript, whatever it is? That wasn't our question. The quality of the manuscripts, the consistency. In other words, let's say we have 10 ancient manuscripts. Does manuscript 1 coincide with manuscript 5? Or do they conflict? Are they saying the same thing? So consistency deals with, are all those manuscripts saying the same thing, or are they conflicting manuscripts? Okay? So how many do we have? How consistent are the manuscripts that we have? And then thirdly, the time span. How much time is there between the original autograph and the first manuscript that we see? Okay? So that's the bibliographical test as it pertains to ancient documents. So let's take a look. I think in your manual you'll see a few of them. We're just going to touch on four of them. First one is Herodotus. He was a Greek historian. Okay, he wrote of the Greco-Persian Wars. He wrote between 488 and 428 BC. The earliest copy we have of his Greco-Persian Wars is around 900. So you see we have a 1,300-year gap between when he originally wrote and when we see the first manuscript. And we have 117 copies to date on Herodotus, okay? Real quick, Thucydides, another Greek historian, wrote about the Peloponnesian Wars. He wrote about the same time. Again, the earliest copies coming out about the same time as well, 1,350 years. We've got 104 copies of Thucydides' writings. And then we have Livy, Okay, Roman historian. He wrote the history of Rome. Wrote between 59 BC and AD 17. Earliest copy we have is AD 400s. Time lapse about 400 years, and we have 169 copies of that. I mean, that's pretty amazing that we still have 169 copies. Okay, now everybody knows about Homer. They always slip this in on me. That Homer. Homer, when he wrote the Iliad, Greek poet, right? The Iliad, Trojan War, written about 800 BC, earliest copy 400. Now, this needs to be updated in your book because I've just looked into this a little bit more. And earliest copy we have is 400 BC, okay? 400 years, and they have recently discovered a whole lot more copies, ancient copies of the Iliad. So we've got 1,757 of those, which is pretty impressive. But let's take a look at the New Testament. The New Testament is the testimony of Jesus Christ, his life, and the history of the church. Okay? It was written between AD 40 and AD 100. We have earliest manuscripts, AD 130. We have full manuscripts of the New Testament, 350 AD. That means we have a time lapse from the writings to the manuscripts of around 90 years. That's pretty amazing. Now, when you look at that, and then when we look at the numbers of copies there are just short of 24,000 manuscripts. I mean, that's a bit of that kind of looks like the Pistons-Pelicans game last night. Was that horrific? Okay. Why did I say that? Okay. 24,000. Now, this is what's interesting as well, is that when you look at, remember, quantity of manuscripts? Remember the second one? Quality, which deals with the consistency of the manuscript. When you look at codex, this number to codex, that number, copy to copy, when you look at the consistency, it is 99.5% consistent. And that has nothing to do with the teachings. It's grammar, or you have an overzealous scribe that wants to add a little commentary to something. But we see here, just on the basis of scientific evidence, there is not a work of antiquity that comes close to the New Testament. Now, does that mean it's the Word of God? No. It just means it's amazingly preserved. I'm not saying it's not, but I wouldn't argue that it is just on the basis of that, though I think that's fairly maybe supernatural that we would have that many copies. And another thought, why would anybody want to make so many copies of something that's not true? Why? Why? So, particularly in that time when you didn't have all the stuff that we have going on today. And so when we look at it, it's interesting with the New Testament is that many people were still alive while the New Testament letters were being distributed, while the Gospels were being distributed. Which I think this next quote by F.F. Bruce. F.F. Bruce was a professor of New Testament criticism at Manchester University. He wrote a book, or several books, but one of the books he wrote is The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? And this is a sort of a long quote from Bruce, but I think it fits the evening perfectly. He says, "It was not friendly witnesses that the early preachers had to reckon with." Okay, do you understand what he's saying? People there, hearing, reading, these were not friendly witnesses that the early preachers had to reckon with. There were others less well disposed who were also conversant with the facts of the ministry and the death of Jesus. The disciples could not afford to risk inaccuracies, not to speak willful manipulation of the facts, which would at once be exposed by those who would be only too glad to do so. On the contrary, one of the strong points of the original apostolic preaching is the confident appeal to the knowledge of the hearers. They not only said, "We are witnesses of these things," but also, "As you yourselves know," had the tendency been to depart from the facts in any material respect, the possible pressure of hostile witnesses in the audience would have served as a further corrective. So it's not like they're forming thoughts and dogma 100, 200, 300, 400 years after the fact. These are happening at the same time in the lives of those who were there. And so all the more historical evidence to support this. Now, on page 14, you'll see that the Bible declares that Jesus is fully human. I think that's there, unless that's been changed in the book. But we see this, that he had a human body. He got tired. He got hungry. He had human emotions, anger, love, sadness. We see this. He had human experiences. He was tempted. He learned. He worked. He was obedient. But here's the real question, as we talk about tonight, who is Jesus? Here's the real question. Was he more than just a man? Was he more than just a great human? Was he more than just a religious teacher? Well, we're just going to take a little bit of time to talk about what did he say about himself, or what is it recorded that he said about himself. And I want you to stick with me here with this, because I want you to fill out some things on page 15 here that I hope you'll take with you. So in John chapter 6, the 35th verse, John quotes Jesus as saying this, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." Now, Jesus is not talking here about physical hunger or physical thirst. He's talking about what we talked about last week. You know, if we looked at that Shia LaBeouf quote, he says that, "I've got this God-shaped hole in me. And if somebody would just give me the answer, I'd just be filled and I'd be on my way." You know, Blaise Pascal, "In every man there is a God-shaped hole that is filled only by Jesus Christ." Well, that's either true or not true. But he's saying, and this is important too. He doesn't say church is or praying is. Now, again, not that those things aren't important if the Bible's true. But he's pointing to himself. We're going to talk about this in just a minute. Beyond his teaching, he's pointing to himself. I mean, if I walked up to you tonight or just said, "Folks, I am the bread of life," you should run out of here as fast as you possibly can. Maybe grab the dessert or some extra food, but get out of here. But this is what he's saying about himself. "I'm the bread of life. If you come to me, you'll not hunger internally. I'll fill that identity, purpose that we talked about last week. And he who believes in me," we're going to really dissect this word, beliefs. "In me shall never thirst." That's quite a bodacious statement. Anybody can say it. The question is that true? Why should I believe that? Then he goes on to say this. Oh, I'm sorry. What he's saying is he fills our emptiness. Okay, you may want to write that right to the next word. He claims that he can fill my emptiness. He can give me purpose beyond the dash. He can give me meaning and identity beyond the dash, in the dash, and in the line forever. Okay. He said this in the 8th chapter of the Gospel of John. He said, here he goes again. "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Now, let me just for a second get you to maybe think about this, and I don't have much time, but yeah, we got a few more weeks, right? So I'm the light of the world. He who follows me, shall not walk in darkness. Now, what is he talking about? After a hurricane. He's not talking about that. We walk in darkness. He's talking about in our souls, there is this sense that though we may go to work every day, we may have money in the bank, that when it comes to really having a sense of who we are, it's like we're walking in the dark. No matter how much success, no matter how many accolades, no matter how much stuff. He's saying, I am the light of the world. So what is he saying here? You may want to just write this in. I think this is what he's saying. He gives direction and purpose. He claims, this is the claim this man makes, I will give you real direction in the dash and on the other side of your last heartbeat forever. Let's look at another one. The Gospel of Matthew, the 11th chapter. Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. He says, take my yoke upon you. What he's talking about here is an oxen yoke, okay? And learn of me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And another, an amazing statement that he makes about himself. Who is he? Well, he claims to be the one that, I'm going to go back for a second, that fills our emptiness, that gives direction and purpose. And look at this. He claims that he is one who can give us peace, a sense of belonging, and that we are never alone. You know, it's fascinating in this world in which there's more communication taking place than ever before. Do you know the number one thing people talk about? Loneliness. They are alone in the midst of thousands alone. Anxiety. We are on, again, we're on more meds than we've ever been on. This sense of anxiety. We're missing peace. A sense of belonging. Is there ever been a time that we're more polarized than we are now? And I'm not just talking about governmentally or politically, just even familially. See, and Jesus makes this statement that if you come to him, he'll take the weariness and the burdens. He'll give rest. Now, again, I'm not saying that you should believe this. We're just reporting what he said, okay? So we're not making any conclusions here. We're just looking at what was said. One last here. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Whoa. Okay. I mean, the other ones were interesting. Now he's talking about some kind of power on the other side of every one of our last heartbeats. He says, I'm the one that determines where you are when you breathe your last. I have that power. Whoa. You believe in me? You'll live even if you die. Not what he's saying, you're going to continue to live physically when you die physically. That's not what he's saying. He says, on the other side of your last heartbeat, like almost all of you said last week, you raised your hand, how many of you believe there's something on the other side of your last heartbeat, you believe it's going to be good, it's going to last forever. Almost everybody's hand went up. Doesn't mean you're right. It's just what you believe. But Jesus is saying, if you believe in me, you'll live, you'll continue to live outside of your earth suit, and everyone who lived, you're going to get a new one. Now that would be great news, right? Great news. Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. But then he said this, and here's a question for you and me to ask ourselves tonight. You believe that? I'm not asking you if you give lip service to that. Do you believe that? Because if you or I believe that, it's going to change where I'm coming from, where I'm going, what I'm doing. Sense of identity and purpose. If this is true. Okay? But it's interesting that Jesus' teaching, I did this twice now, forgive me, eternally secure with God. Now this is amazing. You talk about peace. If this is the truth, there is no reason to be concerned what's going to happen on the other side or your or my last heartbeat, if that's true. And we still haven't talked about a whole lot of evidence about that other than the scripture. which I think is a decent amount of evidence. And again, folks, this is an introduction. We are kind of just scratching the surface of all that there is to delve into, that there's no way we can go into all of that. So his bodacious statement, I'm the resurrection. You believe in me, you are eternally secure with God. Okay? So, now, fascinating thing. And you saw this where Jesus is saying, I am this and I am that. You believe in me. Jesus' teachings all center on himself. And this is fascinating. So if you take Muhammad or Krishna or Buddha or Confucius or Zoroaster or any other religious leaders, you can remove every one of them from their teaching, and their religion, their dharma, their rules and regulations still stand fine. But if you remove Jesus from Christianity, you have no Christianity. Because he's saying, I'm the basis of all this. It all stands and falls on me. And so we see here that throughout the Bible, there are many direct claims that Jesus makes about his being God incarnate. Indirect claims, and there are direct claims. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to only be able to go through one of those, a direct claim, and maybe you guys can, at your tables this evening, go into a passage in the Gospel of Mark. As I said, there are many of them. But let's just look here in the Gospel of John again, just one of them. Jesus says this, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give them. Now, words mean something. I don't want us to just run past this. I give them eternal life. He doesn't say, they paid me, and then I gave them something that they paid for. He said, I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. Okay, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and he who believes in me will never die. And no one, it's amazing, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. You're mine, you're mine. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. Whoa, this is a double grip. It's like a whopper. I mean, you got two hands here. I and the Father are one. And here we go. The Jews picked up stones. Now, this word I think is interesting, this little adverb here. They picked up stones again to stone him. What does that tell you? He said this more than once. They're going after him again. Jesus answered them, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? And the Jews answered him, it's not for a good work that we're going to stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God. Wow. So who was he? Who knows who he was? Well, I want us to take a look, and I mentioned to you last week a guy by the name of C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis was a devout atheist. He was brilliant. PhD in ancient English literature, professor of such at Cambridge and Oxford universities. Well, confronted by the facts, and actually Tolkien was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, and he was a part of a little group called the Inklings, and they would talk about God. And Tolkien and others in this small group, eventually just the evidence and the conversations and the research that Lewis started doing brought him to the place where he actually believed that Jesus was the resurrection and the life. And he surrendered control of his life to God. And in that, he came up with something that maybe you're familiar with this. If you've been to Alpha, you certainly are. But something called decision tree analysis. See, Jesus claimed to be God. That was his claim. We just looked at one of the many passages in the New Testament. Now, he either wasn't or he was. Okay? I think we could agree on that. Is it a yes or no? Now, if he wasn't and he claimed to be, he knew it, or maybe he didn't know it. If he knew it, he was a liar, right? He's saying he's God come in the flesh, but he wasn't. He's a liar. Not only is he a liar, he's a hypocrite, because he's talking about, truly I say to you, I am the truth. You know, abide in me, you'll know the truth. It's a hypocrite. Not only that, he's a demon, because he said he was the way. If you know him in the dash, you will have peace with him, God, forever in the line. He's deceiving and telling you something that is true about God that is not. Not only that, then, he's just a fool. He's an idiot. He's a total fool because he dies for something that he knows is not true. Okay. All right, I'm putting on my faith hat right now and having a difficult position here. A difficult way of grasping this. Maybe he didn't know it. Okay, if he didn't know it, he was nuts. He was a lunatic. Okay? Now, I don't know how this man could be in front of his disciples, in front of his enemies, in front of the most powerful government in the world, and not totally fall apart. It's just not lunatic behavior. He was just sincerely deluded. I don't know. I have a difficult time with that. And C.S. Lewis had a difficult time with that as well, as he smoked his cigarette. I just think that's great. All right. He said this. He said, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he'd be the devil of hell. I guess that would make him a deviled egg. Okay, sorry. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Wow. And so, back to this analysis, this decision tree analysis. He was either a liar or a lunatic, or who he said he was, Lord. And if Lord, then it seems that there's a decision that you and I are faced with, either to reject this, if true, or accept this. And so suddenly, who is Jesus becomes not just a philosophical question, but we have to add a parenthesis to that, I believe. Who is Jesus to you? Who is he to you? Not just historically or philosophically. No, who is he to me? Now, what evidence supports what Jesus allegedly claimed? Well, we've got teachings, we've got miracles, we've got followers, we've got an incredible character. We have prophecies from the Hebrew Scriptures, from the Old Testament. Amazing. We'll talk about those in week 5. These are pieces of evidence. You remember, we're talking about that. Presupposition, faith, authority. What's the evidence to support these claims? But biblical Christianity rises and falls on one piece of evidence. One. Did Jesus come out of the tomb alive on that first Easter morning? Everything stands or falls on that. The Apostle Paul, who was the former persecutor of the church of Jesus, who had an encounter with Christ as written in the book of Acts, where Paul, who was known as Saul, was on his way to kill and imprison more Christians, had an encounter, an alleged encounter with Jesus. And he became an apostle, a devoted follower, and gave up everything for Christ. Well, this is what he writes to the church in Corinth about the resurrection. He says, you got to hear this. This is really good for all of us. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Now, I'm going to get off this for a minute, because I want you to really hear this. This is serious stuff. Okay? This resurrection is central to all of Christianity. And so, hear this and be sobered by this. If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, so is your faith. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God. For we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. And if Christ has not been raised from the dead, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. If only in this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. If there is no resurrection from the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. You hear how serious that is? That is seriously serious. I mean, we just shut this church down right now. We just try to make maybe a public assembly hall or sell it to the government or restaurant. I think we'd make it maybe as a restaurant. But Christianity is not only untrue, it's dangerous. It's deceptive. It's a lie. I mean, there's some nice moral things about it, but it's all based on a lie if Christ is not raised from the dead. And many have tried to explain away his resurrection. But what most agree is this, whether they can explain it away or not, the body was not to be found on that first Easter morning. Then the question would be, then where was it? So we're on page 17 in your. So there are many, many arguments that of which none hold water. That the women went to the wrong tomb. Well, if they went to the wrong tomb, it would be very easy just for them to get reconnected to the right tomb. The disciples stole the body. A fat chance the disciples stole the body, because you remember when Jesus was given up by Judas to the Romans, they all scattered. They were all hiding. The chance of them taking on a Roman guard, overcoming them, pulling this 2,000-pound stone out of the way, grabbing the body of Jesus and saying, he's resurrected, and then dying for it, knowing that it's a lie, pretty slim chance of that. Well, maybe the Jewish officials stole the body. Well, if the Jewish officials stole the body, guess what they're going to do the moment people go to the tomb and say, he's risen? Yeah. Not so much. Or maybe Jesus really didn't die. Maybe he just swooned. I mean, nobody survives Roman crucifixion. Tonight we've got something. If you'd like this, on the physical death of Jesus Christ. If you guys watching live stream would like a digital copy of this, or if y'all would like a digital copy of that, we can get this to you. But this is an article put out in the American Medical Association by several doctors who looked into the physical brutality of crucifixion. Nobody survived crucifixion. Not just the crucifixion, but the beatings that took place prior to crucifixion. Jesus was whipped countless times. When you're whipped, those whips, they weren't long whips, but they're about this long, and they had bone and metal tied into the leather straps. And so maybe some of you have seen The Passion of the Christ, which is probably the closest example of the crucifixion. And so Jesus' back, by the time he got to the cross, was just ribbons. He had lost a tremendous amount of blood. He was probably already in shock. He had been beaten in the face, had the hair pulled from his beard. He'd had this crown of thorns. You know, these aren't the little rose thorns that we deal with today. I mean, these are long things pushed into his head where blood is now coming out of his head. And he is beaten barely alive on the cross. No one survives Roman crucifixion. And you'll enjoy this article if you'd like to have it. And again, many have tried to explain away Christianity. I just brought a few books. Next week, we're going to give you a book. If you're here next week, and if you're watching live stream, we'll mail this to you. A book called The Case for Easter by Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel was the chief legal editor at the Chicago Tribune. And he was a rank atheist. His wife had become a follower of Jesus. And he was doing everything in his power to deliver his wife from this fairy tale. And so he, as an investigative journalist, decided to investigate as a journalist. Well, Mr. Strobel has spoken now all over the world to millions of people and written many, many volumes concerning the evidence to support the validity of Christianity. And so there's one of those little books. It's called The Case for Easter, and we're going to give you a copy of that. Another guy by the name of Josh McDowell wrote a book called More Than a Carpenter. Now, this is the cliff notes of Josh McDowell's cliff notes. I think the books that he has written would stand taller than I. And again, a man who did not believe, was challenged to believe, and became a follower of Christ. This is a British journalist by the name of Frank Morrison wrote this book, Who Moved the Stone? Now, Frank Morrison, so he set off to write this book, and actually, this is really good right here. Can you read that? You can't? Okay. Here's chapter one, the book that refused to be written. He did everything he could to debunk who Jesus is. And just based on the sheer weight, the preponderance of the evidence, he could not do that. So many have wrestled with the question, who is Jesus Christ? And that question, I think, echoes through the canyons of time just into this room tonight, to you and me personally. Not corporately. I'm talking to you. If you're the only person in this room tonight, the only person, you're sitting there in your house watching this. This question comes to each and every one of us. As a matter of fact, Jesus asked his disciples this. So we close. I just want to share this scripture with you from the Gospel of Matthew. I just told you about that. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? They replied, well, some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And then Jesus asked this question, but what about you? Who do you say I am? As I said a moment ago, if the Bible is true, if Jesus rose from that tomb on that first Easter morning, he is the resurrection and the life. Not asking you to believe that. Just looking at the evidence. but who do you say that I am? I mean, maybe tonight you'll ask yourself that question. Maybe in a way you never have asked yourself that question before. For me, let me tell you how I would have asked it. Well, who do you say that I am? Who do you box check that I am on a Sunday morning? And that's it. Who do you give lip service to say that I am? Not that either. But who do you, with full-throated, faith-filled conviction, say, believe, and live that I am? Now, I want to ask you this question, and I hope this question will stick with us through the week, and I'll be done in just a second. What if who I say Jesus is determines who Jesus says that I am? Now think about that. What if who I say Jesus is determines who Jesus says that I am? What if he has a say in this? What if he gets the last word? What if he really is, as we talked about last week, the way, the truth, and the life? What if he really is the bread of life? What if he is the light of the world? What if he is the resurrection and the life? What if he is the one that says, come to me with all your hurt and all your burdens. I will give you rest. What if he is that very person? Well, that's something for us to think about as we hopefully will see you next week. Now look, there's 8 sessions of Alpha. I'm just asking you to come back to one more. Okay, just one more. And of course, the following week, I'll ask you to come back to just one more. But really, a lot of folks, again, we've done Alpha 45 times, and a lot of people say this, that session 1 and session 2 are the warm-up to sessions 3 and 4. Again, that don't believe me. I'm telling you not to believe anything I'm saying, but I want you to believe that because I didn't say it. That's what other people said. And so what are the ramifications for you and me if Jesus did not stay in that tomb and was resurrected? What does who Jesus is really have to do with me and the way I live my life and the dash and what I should expect in the line? This was me. Have you possibly, like I, not critically examined who Jesus is closely enough, or maybe not at all? So we're going to address this next week. Next week's topic, why did Jesus die? I thought I knew. I was shocked that I had no biblical foundation upon which to believe that. So if you will come back next week, you watch again next week, I believe the answers to the question why Jesus died is going to be revelational and hopefully liberational as well to us next week. Hey, not too late to invite friends. Please continue to invite friends. If you're having a good time, please, if you think it means something to someone you know, God, you know, maybe they'll just walk into your path and you say, hey, come with me. Come with me. So anyway, thank you for being here. Let's take a quick break and get back to our tables.